And good morning and welcome to this January 4th, 2017 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Our first show of the new year. And already I'm experiencing some technical difficulties. That's what I love about live radio. However you feel about the new year and what lies ahead, we are the one thing you can depend on, a little literary refuge in the storm. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I am your host for the hour, Marie Stone. So happy to be doing what we always do, which is welcome authors onto the show. I'm excited this morning to be chatting with Reed Crame and Luis Alberto Urrea, always one of my favorite guests to the show this morning. Reed is with me now, and Luis will be with me in the second half of the show. Reed Crame is the author of If Men Were Angels, a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers Selection, and now just out, The Winter in Anna. It's published by Norton, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Reed, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. I really, really enjoyed this novel. So nobody can introduce a novel the way the writer can, so I'm going to let you take us into The Winter of Anna, sort of talk about its inspiration and kind of take us into North Dakota.
I will do that. Well, to take you into North Dakota would be awfully cold right now, so I'll start with just sort of the inspiration for the book. It was driven by a couple different things. As will be no secret, and I'm giving away the first paragraph of the book, but it's only the first paragraph. The book involves a suicide, and I did know a woman a long time ago who killed herself, and her story is not the story of the character in the book at all. But I was thinking about her one night, and I found myself starting to write something, and very quickly I realized that what I was actually writing about wasn't as much her story, but some things I'd been thinking about for a long time. And the thing I had been thinking about for a long time was really the question of how do you take the measure of someone's life when that life ends badly? And so often we tend to focus on the end of a life. And if a life ends badly, if it ends in some unfortunate situation, that's what we remember. And my own father had a life that was very long and successful, but at the end he had lost his job, he had had some problems. And if you took the measure of his life at the very end, it wasn't necessarily a successful life. But if you looked at the whole life, I thought it was much more complicated than that. And that was something I'd been thinking about for a long time. And that led me to this book. And the story of the book, since I know that's what people really want to hear, is a story of a man who discovers that someone he knew and cared about very much when he was young has killed herself. And he then tries to understand how this person he remembered as so full of joy and so full of life could have come to this point. And so the story really is their story, taking a look back when he was young. And it's set in a weekly newspaper in a small town in North Dakota, as you said, and takes a look at basically the year they spent together. And I view it as both a love story, kind of an unusual love story, and in a way, kind of a mystery, because it's not a mystery where you're trying to figure out what happened, but it's a mystery where you're trying to figure out why it happened. And so he takes you through Anna's life and some things he discovered about her, and the things that are happening to them during the course of that year, and that's the journey of the book.
Well described. See, I knew you could do a way better job than. Yeah, I really I thought it was interesting to kind of know the ending at the beginning. You know, I think that's always a hard choice for writers, is to know how to disseminate information and when the reader needs to learn stuff. And so you're right. I mean, we learn right at the very beginning that she's committed suicide, and then it's kind of this unfolding discovery. But with that in the back of our mind and the way she does it, which is, you know, sort of unconventionally a little, not violent, but a little unpleasant.
Yeah.
It really informs the rest of the novel, really informs, I feel like, the melancholy mood, the quiet desperation of the rest of the book, having that in our head. I thought that was a really effective choice. I don't know if that was always your initial choice, was to let the reader in on the, you know, the conclusion.
It was, and it was, I thought it was essential for two reasons. I didn't want to take you through this woman's life and then have it end this way and have you feel like, my God, this thing, all this led up to this sort of cheaply dramatic ending. I wanted to give you what happened to her at the beginning so you could face that, and it would inform the rest of the book, so you'd be trying to understand her the whole way. And And then, you know, I was really glad to hear you say it sort of informs the tone, because that was what I intended. And yet I also wanted to try to balance this. As I was writing, I realized that there was a way in which I thought of this as an essentially joyful book on one level, too, which is the relationship that develops between Eric, the narrator, who at the time when he knows Anna is a very young man, he's only 20, and Anna, who's a little bit older, is essentially a joyful relationship. It's two people discovering how much they need each other and how much they care about each other. And so I wanted that to be part of the book, too. But if that's the general tone of the book, and then all of a sudden at the end you find out this horrible tragedy, I had a feeling you were going to feel that the book had cheated you in an essential way. So I wanted to be upfront about what happened to her. That was the impetus for the entire book. And I thought that lends, I hope, sort of an overall tone, as you said, to the rest of the novel.
Exactly. Right. I agree with you. The other interesting thing, and I was trying to think of another book that has this as an example, is really trying to get to know one of the main characters through the eyes and lens of another character. And, you know, getting to character through another character. And, of course, you know, no one can be perfectly understood. I don't think we can ourselves be perfectly understood. And even Eric was a little bit of a mystery. You know, I mean, he was a little bit inaccessible. To the reader. And I was trying to think of another book that tackles it that way, or if this was kind of a little new invention that you came up with of you know, tackling the main character through another character. I'm sure there are. I just can't think of them.
Well, you know, I don't know that I had any direct inspiration as I was writing it, but at a certain point I realized that it had some similarities with Remains of the Day in one level, and which is that the central character, the narrator, isn't, as you said, Eric remains inaccessible in some ways. He's kind of, at the time when he's 20, he's not that aware of what he's doing himself all the time. And so you have a narrator who doesn't quite completely understand himself at that point. And then I also realized, I mean, a very obvious example is sort of, you know, the American novel set from which characters come from the Midwest, The Great Gatsby, where the narrator is trying to understand the mystery of someone else's life the entire book. All of us who grew up in the Midwest end up at some point mentioning The Great Gatsby when we talk about novels. So that I realized that there were these certain similarities there, that you have one person trying to understand someone else who's central mystery has become tremendously important to them. The difference, of course, is that Eric plays a much larger role in this book than Nick Carraway plays in Gatsby.
Yeah, right. My guest this morning is Reed Krehm. The book is The Winter in Anna, and it is out now and published by Norton. No one does Quiet Despair and Quiet Desperation quite as well as you do, I think.
Thank you. I guess that's a compliment.
It really is, especially coming from me, who is a lover of Quiet Despair. But, you know, I mean, it's in the weather, and it's in the landscape, and it's throughout the minor characters' lives. And, you know, in the subplots, it's just, as you say, there's a joyful quality to their relationship. But there's also just this, through the descriptions of the trees and everything, there's just this kind of wonderful, wonderful desperation. I don't know where that comes from, if that just organically bubbles up in you, but it's really great.
Well, yeah. Maybe it organically bubbles up in those of us who grew up in North Dakota, where winter is about 8 months long. You know, it's interesting to hear you say that. I haven't actually lived back in that state for a long time. It's been probably 30 years, but I do think that is sort of a part of the character of the place and part of the character of the people there. And you know, it's not as though they all walk around perpetually in despair or anything like that. But it is an undercurrent sort of melancholy, I think, in the landscape. It's a pretty stripped bare landscape a large part of the year. And then in the people, I mean, it's a fairly hard life for a lot of people there. And so I'm glad to hear that came through, and I hope it didn't overwhelm some other parts of the book, but that is, I think that represents the reality of the place.
Yeah, no, it's really lovely. It's really lovely. I haven't spent any time in that part of the world, and I really felt connected to the land, you know, in a way an outsider, I guess, would, having never spent any time there. But it felt very real, very alive, and
And, well, that's great.
Yeah.
These are all things I love to hear. So
yeah, it really was great. It's also a wonderful elegy to the dying newspaper industry. And spending time in a newsroom, small as it was, and, you know, kind of seeing how papers get put together, it just made you, made me so wistful and sad for an industry that's really going away. I don't know how you felt about that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I was doing when I was writing the novel initially, that part wasn't as significant, and it was really my wife, Aurelie Sheehan, who's also a novelist, who was reading, I think, the first complete draft, and she said, you know, if I were you, I would just look a little bit more carefully at this part of the book. You have a vanishing era here I don't think you've completely appreciated. And I was part of that era. I mean, the story of Anna and Eric is fiction, but I did work at a weekly newspaper at that age for about a year. And, for instance, Eric's apartment is my old apartment above the bank. I just stole my old apartment. And I started thinking about it, and I realized that I had a feeling of both appreciation and nostalgia for that period that I hadn't really thought about it till my wife mentioned it. And that did become a larger part of the book. And I'm glad to hear you say that you liked it, because I do think it was kind of a special moment. And as you know, the characters in the book don't realize they're right at the edge of an era. They're at the edge where everything's about to change with the advent of personal computers and the Internet. And I think you probably remember, there's a scene in which the first Mac actually shows up in the office. And they're kind of ridiculing it because they don't even have any idea what to do with it. But really, their whole world is about to change at this moment.
And I really remember that point. And, you know, everybody, I think, who's of a certain age will go back to that point in their life and remember when the first computer showed up. And you're like, well, maybe someday we might, you know, we'll never get rid of our typewriter. That's silly.
Right. I remember thinking, this is just so fantastic. It actually corrects words. I can't believe that, you know. And, I couldn't really imagine that it needed to do much more than that, you know. When I was working at the weekly newspaper, I didn't really, you know, I was 20 years old myself. I didn't think that much about how important it was to a community at that time. But looking back, I realized that, and that was one of the things I wanted to celebrate in the book.
Yeah. It's also interesting that Eric is telling the story from a removed perspective of looking back. But we never really get his life now. You know, his current life now isn't informing whatever happened back then, which I really kind of like. I mean, it really has the feel of this frozen in amber kind of time in his life that he's able to, you know, take out and examine without infusing it with all this other stuff from present day.
There's very few places where he really tells you much about his life, from the point at which he's narrating it at all. There's just one or two places. He mentions that he has a daughter at one point, and that is important to the book for a lot of reasons. And then one of the few places where he does back up just a little bit is when he talks about how the fact that they're sort of standing at this moment of profound change, but they can't imagine it. They can't imagine that things printed on paper won't be essential to the world forever, you know. And it was necessary for me to write the book from that perspective. Otherwise, I think you would have been trapped as a writer with this very limited 20-year-old's perspective. And several people have told me, you know, man, he's kind of clueless at certain points. Well, it's okay for him to be kind of clueless when he's 20, but if that had been the entire, you know, perspective of the book, I don't think it would have worked. So I felt just as a writer I had to frame it from the perspective of somebody who has learned a little bit more about life looking backwards.
Yep. My guest this morning is Reed Crame. The book is The Winter in Anna. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Let's get into some little nuts and bolts things of writing. As I was reading this, I thought it almost felt like it could have been written in fragments, you know, that there are really independent scenes that you could have strung together. But I don't know if you kind of structurally how you wrote the book, if you wrote it, you know, straight through page one to page 250, or if you, you know, kind of played around with character, wrote a vignette here, wrote a fire scene there, and then strung it together, or kind of how you approach structure when you were first drafting it out.
Well, when I first drafted it, I did write it from front to back, but it was probably 50 pages shorter than it is now. And it's important for me when I'm writing a first draft not to edit myself and not to limit myself and to try to maintain forward momentum. So I try to get through something. And then I tried to suddenly change personalities, change roles, and become an editor of my own work. And when I had finished the first draft, I felt that it was a bit thin, that it needed a few more scenes. It needed to fill out their relationship in certain ways. And I also realized that I needed to add more depth, to make some of the minor characters more complete human beings. And as I did that, they developed some of their own stories, and that started to fill out the book, too. So there are, you're an attentive reader, because there are scenes that were added later. And that often works for me. And I've read somewhere that, you know, writers are either people who add in or take out as they revise. And I'm a person who almost always ends up adding in as I revise. I take some stuff out, too, of course, but generally I try to, you know, deepen and make the book richer as I'm editing and rewriting.
Yeah. You brought up minor characters, and I'm always interested in talking to writers about their minor characters because, you know, this is a populated town with, you know, kind of a cast of people, and they have really compelling stories. I really thought your study of marriage and what marriage means and how marriage functions for different couples in the town was really very interesting. But let's talk a little bit about the minor characters and how much you feel like you needed to know them, how much of them made it onto the page versus, you know, how much you know about them in your head that just kind of informed when it went on the page, and talk about some of your favorite minor characters and drawing them to life.
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, a lot of times when I start out with a minor character, I start out using the physical characteristics of someone I knew a long time ago, just because I need to anchor the person in some concrete reality. And so, you know, I may know, in my previous novel, I worked with a woman once who was always wearing just wild stockings that had the craziest things on them. They'd have, like, the pattern of the Rolling Stones tongue or something on her stockings all the time. So I use that little bit in a character, but then there's always a point when these characters who I first start out by using sort of the physical reality of somebody I knew or was acquainted with a little bit, when the fictional character totally takes over and they become a real person to me, and I forget any connection to any actual person in the real world, and they become very real to me, and they have their own lives, and I will think a lot about that life. And you're right, I only use certain parts of it because they aren't the central character in the story. But there is a point in which, you know, the entire world becomes very real to me. And so when it becomes real to you, these people, you don't even have to think about what these characters are going to say in the book because they just say what they say. And so for all of them, yeah, I have sort of visions of their lives. And the couple, I don't want to give away anything, but the couple that run the newspaper became very favorite minor characters of mine. I loved sort of the combination of eccentricity and then sort of genuine concern for their employees that came to exist in the book. So those were two people I enjoyed writing as time went on.
I felt like they could have their own book someday. I'd really like
yeah,
to
maybe.
See. I don't want to leave them alone. I really
yeah.
I don't want to live in their house, but I want to visit their house as a fly on the wall.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was interesting. You know, the book became an exploration of relationships as Eric is trying to understand things and Anna is helping them to understand some things. And so that story, you know, I wish I could say I, like, cleverly thought this all out ahead of time. I didn't. But that story ended up working very well as sort of a counterpoint to some of the other things going on in the book.
Really well. Yeah, really well. And in terms of setting and landscape, and I know you grew up in North Dakota and you haven't spent time there. I can't think of more of the polar opposite. Well, I'm sure I could, but more polar opposite than now living in Arizona as a counterpoint to living in North Dakota.
That is true.
But I'm wondering if it seems easier for you to access that place, access that time with a little bit of distance, or if you think... or if you went back up there to visit to get details right, or, you know, kind of being in a place and writing about it versus having some distance and time away from it and writing about it?
Well, I think, first off, my mother still lives up there, and I have a sister who still lives up there, so I get up there. But I do think you need some distance. I think when I was younger, my feelings about it were much more complicated, and it was a place I wanted to get out of when I was growing up at a certain point. And, and um, And so you do need some distance. But I also think it's, I mean, I had an interesting conversation with my daughter once. We were driving across North Dakota, and I was taking her to spend some time with her grandmother. And she said, "Is this the landscape you see when you dream?" And, you know, I haven't lived there for many years, but I thought about it, and I thought, you know, I think it still is. I think it's still often the landscape that shows up in my dreams. And she said, the reason she asked that is she said, in my dreams, it's always desert. And because she's grown up here, of course. And but I think, you know, that first place you grow up imprints you in such a fundamental way that it stays with you for a long time. And I lived there till I was in my early 20s. So I think it's in my bones at this point.
I have that conversation with writers all the time, that wherever you grew up, it's on you, like you can't get it off your back. I really feel that's where people return. I don't know if it's because you're in a place before you have language, you know, and so you're, you don't have the words to describe it, and so you spend the rest of your life trying to, you know, do that, or I don't know what it is, but.
You know, everything is larger, too, when you're a child. I mean, everything's larger and just comes with some sort of significance. I drove back once. I was there for a story assignment. I'm also a journalist, and I was there for a story assignment, and I drove to the town that I lived in until I was five, and then we moved to a different town in North Dakota. And you know, I barely remember it, but I do remember this grove of trees across this field, and I'd asked my mother where our old house was, and nothing changes in North Dakota, so the house was still there. And the grove of trees was still there across this field, and I was looking across, and I thought, this used to seem like some immense distance that I hiked across as a little kid, and it's like 55 yards away, you know. And so there's this just kind of mythic significance, I think, that comes with those first memories.
Yeah, right. So we've touched a little bit on your revision process, but I want to get back to that because I think that is so important for writers. I feel like too many writers are really trying to get their stuff out too quickly without, you know, really taking the time to make sure everything is perfect. And first tell me how, what time period this was written over and, you know, how much time was spent on first draft versus how much time was spent on revision.
Sure. Well, first, I would say one thing. I think writers have two problems. I've seen a lot of people who struggle to be writers who get too concerned about the editor sits too heavily on their shoulder when they're trying to write their first draft. They're too self-critical when they're trying to write their first draft, and they have this, you know, God, I've got to get it perfect now, or it's just going to be crap forever. And that's not true, of course. And so when I talk to students, one of the things I tell them is, you know, when you're writing your first draft, just be fearless. You know, just keep writing. Be fearless. Don't be afraid to take some chances. You can always take it out later. That's the nice thing about writing. And but then, at that point, then there's a point in which you have to shift over. And for me, it always helps to have a little time. Now, I also write. I write for magazines. I write online. I do a lot of nonfiction journalism. And so I have natural breaks. What will happen is I get to a point where I'm so busy with other work where I simply can't think about my novel for a month or two. And that is always good for me. Whenever something like that happens and I have come back, I'm able to see it with fresh eyes. And after that first draft, I start becoming my own editor. And then I look at things much more critically. And I try to look at things from the point of view of my audience and say, okay, I like this, but is it just going to feel self-indulgent to other people? It took me about 3 years to write this book, but really that's kind of not quite right because, like I said, there were periods where I just had to set it down because of other work. I think I wrote the first draft relatively quickly, but as I said, then I had to add in a lot of stuff. The second and the period of revision for me at this point in my life is actually the part where I really feel like a writer. I mean, I write the first draft, but it's the revision process where I think I'm drawing on, you know, whatever craft I have and whatever knowledge I have. And that, to me, I've noticed that young writers are always obsessed with the first draft. Veteran writers care a lot more about the revisions, and that's where I'm at this point in my life. To me, when I'm revising, that's where I really feel like, okay, I'm doing my work now. You know, I'm doing the work that a writer should do right now.
Yeah. I've heard from a couple of novelists or several novelists that the second novel is the tough one, that the first one, for whatever reason, it's easier to publication or it's easier to something. And then the third one, now you've got your wings under you and you're taking off. Second ones are tough. Did you find that?
Well, yes, because I tried a couple other novels and then sort of like, this isn't working. And so it took me a while to find something that I felt good about. And then also, My first novel is a political novel. The narrator is once again a journalist, but the first one is a political novel set on a presidential campaign, and it has sort of this kind of classic big screen level of activity going on. You know, I mean, you know, you've got the stakes of a presidential campaign, you have all this stuff, and this novel is quieter. I mean, I think what it's talking about is just as important, if not more important, but it's a quieter, simpler novel, and I wanted to do that. I wanted to write a story that was more intimate, a story that was really about, you know, two people in a small community, and I needed to do that just for myself. I needed to do... I'm not the kind of person who likes to do anything twice. I could never write a mystery series. I love these people. I love people who can do this, but I could never write a murder mystery series where I used the same characters for 15 books. It just wouldn't work for me. And for me, the shift to this sort of quieter, more intimate setting was part of the thing that made this book worth writing.
Yeah, fantastic. We're drawing it down on our time, but I wonder if you have words of inspiration as we go into this new year, words of it, this crazy new year, or, you know, what you're reading, what advice you give to writers, all that kind of stuff.
You know, the only advice I give to writers really is, don't be afraid to finish stuff. So many people I know start novels, then get, you know, they get, if you start a novel and finish it, you have to face, or any long work, whether it's a novel or screenplay, then you have to face the possibility that maybe you will fail. Maybe you won't be happy with it, or maybe it won't get published if that's your measurement of success. But anybody who sits down and works their way through an entire book and finishes it to the best of their ability has my respect. That's really all you can do. So, you know, my advice to writers is write fearlessly and don't be afraid to finish things.
Yeah.
If you don't finish, you can always say to yourself, "Well, I never got it done. Who knows what would have happened?" You know, and you offer yourself an escape hatch in that regard. A couple weeks ago, I sat down with a group of writers at a fair and a book fair, and they invited me to be part of it. And I sat down, and everybody except me at the table was self-published. I realized it, and so one of the people said, "Oh God, we're all self-published, and you've got to." You know, a publisher in New York and everything. And I said, you know, to me, all of you wrote these books, you finished these books, that's what matters, and you should really be proud of that.
I love that.
And that's really what I felt.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. How do we find you? You're hard to find online. You're very mysterious.
My daughter gives me endless grief about this. I'm not really a social media person. I spend so much time interviewing people, doing stuff as a journalist that the idea of sort of like then living my social life online is always been repellent to me. I just want to get away. I want to go for a walk at that point. But I am actually going to put up a website, and I'm there. You can find my magazine articles, that sort of thing. And I am going to set up a website in the next week or so. My wife has been bugging me about this, and I'm going to do it.
I love it. A good New Year's resolution.
Yes.
Reed Crame, this was a huge pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Me too. That was Reed Crame. The book, The Winter in Anna, is out now, published by Norton. We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Luis Urrea will be on for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. There's a really cool speaker series event coming up at the end of this month, kind of mid-end of this month. I think there are tickets still available, so check that out. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I am not going to do Luis Urrea's biography justice, or we won't have time to talk at all, but he has written a lot across fiction, nonfiction, short fiction, poetry, a comic book, for God's sake. He's been on the show a few times, and you can find old podcasts on our website. Suffice it to say that NPR has called him a literary badass and a master storyteller with a rock and roll heart. He was a 2005 Pulitzer Prize finalist, He is the best-selling author of like 16 books. I'll also point out that the collection we're talking about today, which is the Water Museum, won the 2015 Penn Faulkner Award and was named Best Book of the Year by the Washington Post, among other places. And one of the stories in this collection won an Edgar Award for the Mystery Writers of America for Best Short Story. Amapola was originally published in 2009 in Phoenix Noir. For more on Luis, you can check out his amazing website. There are videos of him. It's a really great website, Luis Urrea, to learn more. Luis, welcome back.
Hi, Marie.
Thank you for coming back on. I always love our time together.
Yeah, we have a great time.
We do. So some of these stories have been in the world for a while, and I just wanted you to talk about the collection, sort of globally, what you were thinking about across the stories and you know, how you decided to do a short story collection after all the wonderful novels.
Yeah, you know, I'm at that really weird place where, you know, everywhere I go, I meet people who haven't read my stuff yet, and they always say, well, what should I read? And I thought, gosh, what do you tell them? Yeah. You know, and then you ask them, well, what is your taste? Do you like poetry? Do you want Chicano lit? Do you like gruesome and dark nonfiction? Do you like various forms of... I don't know what to tell them. And, you know, I have all these stories, and my wife calls this the gateway drug. And I try to be a little bit more PC, so I've been calling it the Whitman sampler. I thought, you know, I can give them a little book that's got all the different kinds of fiction stuff I do, and maybe they can be directed toward it. So that's been a service that way. But also, you know, I didn't realize where things were going to go politically and so forth in our country. But I was sensing already this feeling of a little bit of melancholy, it seemed to me, and this may be just because I'm getting older now, that we have so many things that we take for granted in our lives, and we don't necessarily realize it or acknowledge it or honor it until it's almost too late or too late. Once things have passed or we've lost them or we're losing them, I think we start to panic a little bit and mourn those things. And so it seemed to me that there was a certain part of my writing that really dealt with loss and meaning, soul meaning. And it seems to me that real soul resides in very small quotidian daily details of our lives that we take for granted. So I tried to get all the stories that had that kind of an element together. For example, the title story, Water Museum, nobody really knows this, but it's the only, I think, arguably anyway, the only full-on kind of fantasy science fiction-y story in the book. Mm-hmm. And it's my homage to Ray Bradbury, mm-hmm. because I... You know, Ray Bradbury sort of coached me into the world of story when I was reading him frantically as a kid.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's told a little bit in a Ray Bradbury tone, in that you don't necessarily know something fantastic and out of the ordinary is going on until later in the story. And it's basically a story about the drought we experienced here in the Midwest. And I was really moved reading this article that there were these drought remediation foundry repair companies now, because the ground was pulling away from the foundations of homes.
Wow.
The earth itself was receding in the drought. Wow. Right? And guys are going out there and trying to reconnect the earth to the foundations of your house. And so I thought, what would happen if this were it? If global warming, in spite of what you're hearing on certain news channels,
yeah.
What if it really exists, ahem? And what if it is the new normal? And what would happen to children who were raised without rain?
Yeah.
And so, you know, you realize, I think, that you're facing weirdness by the end of the story when once in your school life, the school takes all of your kids to a water museum so they can see water.
Right, right. It's funny you said that you didn't see what was coming politically, because few stories in here led me to believe you may have seen exactly what was coming in this new state of the world.
Well, yeah, but, you know, once we all got the tag of nasty women and bad hombres, I thought, yeah, this is going to be okay. It's going to be okay. And, you know, we in Chicago, I think, took a super hit because we were all giddy with the Cubs winning the World Series, and we all thought, yes, this is it.
Yeah.
Miracles, season of hope. And then, oh, what happened?
Right.
What in the world just happened? And we've talked about stuff before, but I started out my writing life, if you want to call it that, as a missionary to the poor in Tijuana,
yeah,
working in the Tijuana garbage dump. And so I've seen, I'm from the border, as you know, I was born in Tijuana, come from a dirt street in Tijuana, the kid, you know, with tuberculosis, spitting up blood as a little kid on a dirt street in Tijuana. So I'm fully aware of the wonders and miracles of being in the United States. But I also have a very graphic reminder of what life is like for people who are in our shadow. And I see all those things going on, and I have tried to bear witness and fight the good fight for a long time. But I honestly thought that something that felt to me very positive was happening. And it evaporated so resoundingly and shockingly that I think I'm still kind of in shock over it.
Yeah.
Though I know my conservative friends love it and razz me, and they say, you know, the tears of a liberal are the sweetest drink in the world.
Oh, Jesus.
But I think, you know, it's going to be on us. It's going to be on artists as activists and warriors to stand up and try to help. They need a lot of healing out there.
Yeah, they really do. Yeah, I mean, what we were at Tin House this last summer, and there was that mood of there's something really shifting under our feet here, and I think a lot of the writers there were feeling that.
Tin House is interesting because it took a real turn toward soul.
Yeah, right.
And I thought that was fascinating, you know, and they asked me to give the closing talk, and I, you know, and they wanted it to be a soul-stirring talk, and it was a real gift. You know, it was a kind of a wonderful thing to lock myself away in an apartment every day of Tin House with crows begging for donuts outside and banging away this thing about soul.
Yeah, that was
great.
Incredible. That was incredible. Speaking of Tin House, your reading there, it wasn't even a reading, it was really like a performance. It was just mesmerizing. And,
thanks.
It's such an incredible experience, but I thought it was also a great lesson for writers to have this relationship with your own work, to be that much inside of it that it's almost, you know, it's almost you're like channeling something. And I wondered if it feels that way when you're writing, or if that's just kind of strict performance art, and you know, you don't access that when you're writing. I don't know.
Well, I'm a little goofy about this, but you may appreciate this. You know, I spent 25 years working on The Hummingbird's Daughter and its sequel. And, you know, a lot of that time was spent with medicine people and shamans and medicine women in particular. And I was really blessed, I think, to have the women's sacredness community accept me as a male and teach me. And that really, that was life-changing in ways that are hard for me to really express. And at the time, at a certain moment, in 1994, 95, I went to Tucson to be near the Yaqui people that are in the book. And my life kind of came apart at the seams. All kinds of things went awry. And, you know, I was there with no money and no relations and under incredible stress. And I was sort of reduced to not being able to think very clearly in the midst of all of my panic. And I remember not being able to read anymore. I couldn't, and I thought, how am I supposed to write this book? I can't even, my mind can't settle down to read a full book, even a story. What's wrong with me? And it turned out to be a blessing because I started reading haiku. I thought, you know what, 17 syllables, I'm good. I can do that. And the more haiku I read, the more it kept opening these pathways for me. And that in combination with these holy teachers made me start reevaluating the writing life, and it suddenly stopped being a career and started being what I realized was my actual spiritual practice. It was my soul yoga, being a writer, the process of writing. So when you ask about that, it's not really performance art for me. It is an element of performance art in that you have to be sure that you're going to give your audience everything you can. I feel as though I have to sort of catch fire up there and burn as brightly as I can burn, or else I'm cheating the people who've come, because people come to you out of love and openness and curiosity. You know, a lot of writers are afraid of their audiences because they think that it's what it isn't. Yeah. People are there rooting for you, but they're also rooting for themselves. They, especially now, people need and want to be moved and to feel a connection to something. And so, you know, when I do those things, those stories from the heart, because it's not really from the mind, you just go in and leap. That is really, not to get too groovy about it, but it's really sacred. And you feel it. You can tell when it's not happening.
Yeah.
But that's very rare. It almost always happens. And it's in some non-religious way, I will say, a form of prayer.
Yeah.
And it's a really beautiful form of communion. And I feel that the people who come to see me are giving me a great gift, and I want to give them a gift back.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I told you it was, I felt like I didn't breathe or blink for 50 minutes. I mean, you do. You just feel transported somewhere else. Like you're just, you know.
Wow.
This journey. It's really, it was just amazing. It's amazing.
Well, you know what? Probably the secret is that, you know, I grew up wanting to be Jim Morrison. So.
I can tell.
And then later David Bowie. So who knows? You know, maybe. So I never learned how to play guitar. So that's my fake way of getting up there and being a rock star.
So good.
Maybe I could actually, you know, kick over the amp or something.
You are a rock star. You don't have to work any harder at it. You are.
Oh, no. I am a suburban dad with a fat dog. That's me.
Well, speaking of your love of music, I mean, obviously these stories are just dripping with it. And I don't know if you listen to music a lot while you're writing, or
yes, ma'am.
Your relationship with music. Yeah, tell me about your relationship with music.
I you know, Leonard Cohen. What can I tell you? I come from a complicated home, and it wasn't happy. And both of my parents were plagued because of their pasts by hideous nightmares. So, and they slept in separate rooms. They wanted to get away from each other and couldn't. They slept in separate rooms, and they never touched each other, and they didn't like each other much. And he had horrible nightmares and ground his teeth until all of his teeth broke. And she had horrible nightmares. She had been in World War II, was dreaming about liberating Buchenwald and things at night. And so you'd hear my father grinding and breaking his teeth all night, and my mother yelping and crying out and yelling, no, 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 all night. So I was a bit of an insomniac. And I would be in my bedroom, and I would be listening to Leonard Cohen and Sean Phillips, and probably Bob Dylan, certainly John Lennon, and reading all night. Mm. And there was that funny moment when I decided I would try it myself. I thought, this is great. And I remember seeing in the bookstore, I talk about this sometimes, but seeing in the bookstore Jim Morrison's book of poems, The Lords and the New Creatures. And then realizing that right next to it was Leonard Cohen's book of poems. And right next to that was Bob Dylan's Tarantula, and right next to that was John Lennon's A Spaniard in the Works. And I thought, wait. These guys, they typed this stuff. They wrote somewhere. It didn't just happen. You don't just put on leather pants and have it happen. And that was this amazing transformative moment for me, because I was reading Bradbury a lot. I was reading Stephen Crane's poetry. I had discovered Charles Bukowski. I thought I was such a toughie. Oh, man. He talked about being drunk and he used bad words. I thought that was pretty hip. But it all came together, and, you know, lifetime love of music. A lot of people in my family are musicians. And then that hit in late junior high. And by the time I got in high school, I was the guy with the notebook. I didn't have money. I couldn't dance. Didn't have a car. I had no hope for anything. But I had my notebook, and I wrote all the time. And I sort of became, you know, my grade's poet. And as fate would have it, a lot of the people that became my best friends were musicians. And so I started writing lyrics for them. That was back in the era when bands had that mysterious lyricist, you know? It was like, of course, Elton had Bernie Taupin, but King Crimson had a lyricist. Cream had a lyricist. Procol Harum had a lyricist. So I would fancy myself, you know, the mysterious sixth member of all these teenage bands with my lyrics. But it was a beautiful thing, because it was all homework. I didn't realize that the more you try to figure out how to write a good lyric, the more you're honing everything else. And I can't overemphasize in my adolescent spawning the effect of love. Yeah. If you don't have a car, you don't have money, you can't do a doggone thing about dating anybody, but you figured out how to write poems.
Oh, yeah.
That works.
That works, yep.
It works really well.
That is a straight shot to a woman's heart, absolutely.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, yeah. It was, you know, it's all I had.
Yeah.
But it was a nice thing to have.
So you're probably a fan of the Nobel Peace or Nobel Literature Prize this year.
You know what I was a fan of? I was a fan of the controversy over it. So many people losing their minds. And I loved Dylan's comment, "I never once considered my songs literature," which I thought was a pretty good response.
Yeah.
But, you know, for the effect that he had. And you might like this, but I tell you, I always loved Dylan. And I always loved, especially It's All Right, Ma, I'm Only Bleeding. And I think that song had a massive effect on me when I realized that I could not imagine how somebody would create an avalanche of words like that, that were so intense and so beautiful and so upsetting and so true. It was a bomb going off in a teenager's mind, certainly. But I had this experience when I was deep in Mexico, in Sinaloa, in my family's birthplace. And my uncle, I mean, this is something right out of a book. In fact, this has made its way into stories and books. But my uncle owned a radio station, right, and a movie theater. So I went from being poor ghetto boy to going down there to living this life of luxury, you know, going to the movies every night in my family's movie theater. But he hated rock music, so he gave me all the promotional records. He wouldn't play them. So I'd go down there in the summers and receive a cardboard box full of records. And sitting in Sinaloa, feeling lost in this house with geckos on the walls, which I'd never seen before, and all this tropical stuff going on, and hearing Mr. Tambourine Man. And realizing what that song was really about and how it drove this weird spike through my heart. It was the most perfect little moment of art I had ever experienced. It was in 1970. It completely I almost levitated. It was so perfect and sorrowful and wistful all at once. It's things I had no language to explain the effect on me.
Yeah.
You know, so music to me is as direct a line to that eternal thing that I'm talking about, the path one walks, as writing is, when writing really, really connects with you profoundly.
Yeah. I can't tell if you have just an exceptionally wonderful family for writing. All the characters in your family, and I've heard about your aunt, your grandmother. I mean, they're all just, they're so great. I don't know if it's you observing them and your wonderful observations of them, if we all have a family like that, if we'd only just look, or if you just have really an exceptional family for a writer.
Yeah, somebody wrote to me, actually, and reminded me of this, and it made me really happy, but apparently someone asked me about that, and I said, I come from a family of unreliable narrators. And I think that was part of it. You know, these folks were just all enamored of BS. They would never stop telling these tales about mostly themselves. They were quite self-regarding, you know. But the thing that haunted me was coming to the U.S., and I lived, you know, in the barrio. But then in fifth grade, at the end of fourth grade, there was this cataclysmic rupture in that I left Mexico world. My mom and dad moved up into a white working class suburb up in San Diego. And all of a sudden, overnight, Mexicans were basically echoes of what we heard in the campaign, you know. Back then, even, they were rapists, they were murderers, they were filthy, they were greasers, they were wetbacks, they were beaners. I was so completely shocked. I had thought, up until fifth grade, that we were human beings. And in fifth grade, suddenly everyone around me, it seemed, felt that we were subhuman. And everyone I thought was sacred, everyone I revered, because they were the only people I knew, were being disparaged and called out and called names, as was I. And I used to have a strong Tijuana accent. I could still go there right now. I could talk like this all day long because my family talks like this a lot still today. And boy, did I become American super fast. Fifth grade, survival. My accent vanished. And, you know, I felt ashamed of that for a long time until I realized that I was facing something I did not understand. And I just thought, you know, most of my family looks Irish. I look Irish. By God, I'm just going to be Irish until I figure this thing out.
Yeah. Do you think books were kind of your way out? 'Cause it feels,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yes. And, you know, they were such a deliverance.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I always devoured books, always. And once I became a poetry fiend, I even had secret books. You know, it's like a double library. There are all these books people read, but then you've got this really good stuff in the shadows, which are these poetry books. So, yeah.
I love it. Well, we're drawing down on our time, but which is killing me, really. But I'm looking to you for kind of words of hope, what the responsibility of writers is in this new age, how you're tackling this new year that we're facing.
Oh, gosh. You know, when I started publishing books, especially about the border, I got some really weird angry responses, you know, sometimes even death threats for what I had written. And I'm kind of thinking that those days may be coming back. I don't know. People have been very kind for about 10 years, but I think it's going to get hairy out there. But I think this is the time to not despair. This is the time to not back down, not stop. You've got to do your work, and you've got to do it even more. So my response is stepping up. I'm stepping up what I produce, and you know, I'm trying to do as much hands-on service as I can. And you know, my wife and I, my whole family and I, want to keep trying to take the responsibility for the way things are going on ourselves. I'm not waiting for somebody. I posted this on Facebook yesterday, I think, that I waited and waited for a, you know, for a leader to show up. And I realized I'm the leader.
Yeah.
We're the warriors. We are the light. And, you know, we must do what we're going to do. And if what I suspect is true, all rancor and anger aside, because I have a lot of friends who are Trump supporters, and they're good folks. It's easy to say, oh, they're terrible people that hate. No, they have their reasons. I happen to think they're wrong. And if I am right that they're wrong, I think there's going to be a lot of work to do helping those folks, you know, without a supercilious attitude, without mockery, when they see their dream not being fulfilled, they feel betrayed. There's going to be a lot of healing opportunity out there.
Yeah.
So, you know, we are not permitted to not shine.
I love that. That's right. That's right. I saw that great photo you put up yesterday about all the wonderful Moleskine notebooks that are filling up on your desk. That was great.
Yeah, I put a picture of a pile of notebooks on my desk. Yeah.
I can't wait to open them up and see them.
there's some juicy stuff in there.
I'll bet. Luis Urrea, this is always so much fun for me. I really, really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks again.
All right.
That was Luis Urrea. The book is The Water Museum. He's got so many wonderful books out there. You can check him out on his website. You can find him all over the place. If you get a chance to see Luis in person, I can't recommend it highly enough. It's talk about a spiritual experience. It really is. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you as we always are every Wednesday morning at 9 next week. Stay tuned. There is some awesome music coming up on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Thanks for joining me. Have a great, great day.